Let's open our Bibles to Psalm 32. Psalm 32. Preparation for the study of God's Word, and use 1 John 1:9 if necessary. Shall we pray? We're thankful once again, Father, for the privilege we have of studying your Word. May each one of us benefit and may Jesus Christ be glorified. But we ask it in his name. Amen. Psalm 32. As you can see, it's the second line under the psalm. It says, a psalm of David. That masculine simply indicates a type of song. And this is a good psalm to look at in regard to thanksgiving because it recognizes the provisions of God. It recognizes the provisions of God, first of all, in the area of salvation, then in the area of fellowship, and then in the area of everything that God provides for us. And then the psalm ends with the fantastic principle of inner happiness and inner joy and the overt joy of the abundant life. So it's a pretty good psalm to look at from that perspective. It begins with a very familiar phrase for us in verse 1, how blessed. Now you understand, or should by now, that when you see how blessed in the Old Testament, it looks like this. A-S-H-E-R, long A, and it should be pronounced Asherai. And Asherai means maximum happiness. It's a plural word, and therefore you actually have the idea of happinesses or joys. And it's saying that joy to the one, this is actually what you have, is joy to the one. Which means the experience of joy, the experience of inner happiness, the inner peace, inner contentment, inner relaxation, because you have some problem, some issue resolved in your life. Now, this can refer to anything that comes your way. In the context of the psalm, this inner joy, this inner relaxation is because there's something resolved with regard to your salvation, with regard to your relationship with God. Things are resolved with regard to the sin problem. How blessed or how happy is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. You have two things then with regard to our salvation orientation. You've got the idea of forgiven, and you've got the idea of covered. Now both of these words are used from the context of the Old Testament. Because we're dealing in our Old Testament economy, and Jesus Christ, as the Messiah, has not come yet. He has not performed his work on the cross. He has not paid for sin. But in the plan of God, in the plan of God, it was, of course, anticipated, indeed, arranged in eternity past that the Messiah would come on the scene and pay for the sins of the world. Ever since the very first salvation promise, in Genesis 3:15, this was communicated to man. The seed of the woman promised that he, the seed of the woman, would crush Satan on the head, and Satan would only bruise the seed of the woman. The Messiah would then encounter a minor blow when he went to the cross and encountered not only physical death, but also encountered an excruciating spiritual encounter with separation from God. But in the process of going through this minor blow, or this apparently minor setback, Jesus Christ actually accomplished a fatal blow upon the head of the serpent, upon the head of Satan. And therefore, through the resurrection, Satan's destiny was once and for all finalized, and he was destined without any recourse now to the lake of fire. So, throughout the Old Testament, all the teaching was geared to looking forward to the coming of that sacrifice of Christ, and it was taught through what? What was the teaching aid that taught about the coming of Christ? The animal sacrifices were used to teach. And therefore, you have the idea of forgiven and covered. Notice the word covered. We don't use this word covered in the New Testament, because covered is an Old Testament concept. Covered does not mean paid for. Covered means covered over and not dealt with right now. We're going to just kind of cover it and not worry about it. You're sinful, you're a stinker, you're rotten, but we're just going to put a cover on it. We're just going to put a lid on it, not worry about it until later. When Jesus Christ then came to the cross, all the sins that were covered in the Old Testament were uncovered, thrown upon Jesus Christ, and he paid for them. So forgiven emphasizes the salvation provision that is provided because of the looking forward to the coming of Christ. So forgiven does refer to an animal sacrifice, and utilizing that animal sacrifice and what that animal sacrifice taught in the Old Testament, so that you did acquire a forgiveness of sin. Now, forgiveness of sin simply means that God does not hold it not going to look at you and say, you cannot have fellowship with me. I'm going to forgive your sin. You are an enemy. You're rebellious. You're a stinker. But I'm going to forgive you. This is forgiveness. And it's based on the animal sacrifice. But the reason David now also mentions the idea of the sin being covered, because he wants to make it very clear that the sin, although forgiven, is not paid for. It's only covered. For all intents and purposes, for the believer in the Old Testament, the effects were one and the same. The fact that his sin was not paid for, but was only covered, still enabled him to have relationship and indeed fellowship with God. But this just helps us understand a little bit about the Old Testament perspective. How blessed then is he whose sin is forgiven, whose sin is covered. The idea of covering them once again is to hide or to cover over. And remember, the animal sacrifice did not pay for sin. All it did was provide a forgiveness, provide a cover. If indeed the animal sacrifices paid for sin, there would have been no need for the sacrifice of Christ. We just have animal sacrifices. But the animal sacrifices did not pay for sin. They only covered. Looking forward and anticipating a greater sacrifice. Now this is all explained, of course, in the book of Hebrews, in several chapters. Chapter 10, 1 through 4, you might put down and look at it sometime. It talks about the fact that the animal sacrifices could not pay for sin, and it awaited the need for another sacrifice, that sacrifice being Christ. Then in verse 2, it moves on further. It says, how blessed, it repeats the promise of happiness, how blessed is the man to whom the Lord, here we have the Lord in all caps, so it's Jehovah, the man to whom Jehovah does not impute iniquity. Now, this imputation of iniquity is holding to your account your sin. In other words, Jehovah does not look at your sinful status and say, you're a sinner, I don't want anything to do with you. But instead, he does not impute. See, he does not hold it to your account. The word impute simply is an accountant-type term. And he doesn't put it on your account. He does not look at you and say, all I see is sin. But because you have adjusted to God on a salvation basis, in verse 1, God can now look at you and say, I don't hold sin against you. You now have the basis for fellowship with me. But the basis for fellowship with me is for you to perpetuate in your life a dedication attitude toward God. And that is represented with the phrase, and in whose spirit there is no deceit. Now the word deceit can also be translated deception. You have the same concept. The Hebrew word is remia. Does that sound like deception? R-E-M-I-Y-Y-A-H. Remia. Two Y's there. And that's the word translated deceit or deception. This refers, of course, to mental attitude, deception. And it indicates a failure to apply righteous standards in your soul so that you have a deceptive mental attitude. You try and deceive others. You try and deceive yourself, indeed. And you even try to deceive God. Now, you can deceive others, and you can oftentimes succeed in deceiving yourself, but you can never, ever deceive God. It is, of course, an impossibility. But we have, then, a second promise in connection with the happiness spectrum, if you please, and that is, in whose spirit there is no deceit. Now, the word spirit is used because the human spirit is the reflector of the soul. And as goes the soul, so goes the spirit. So that if the soul has truth in it, the soul has righteous standards there, then this will be reflected outside into the spirit. And this will be how our personality is expressed. In other words, you've probably seen and heard of people who have a deceptive personality. Well, this is the spirit reflecting itself. And that's what this is talking about. Deception is the first area where sin begins. Deception, many, many areas. Deception involves a lot more than what we normally think of. Deception, you think of, well, I'm, you know, trying to trick this guy. That's not all deception is. Deception means you're trying to get away with violating divine standards. You're trying to get away with it. And see, this is summed up, not summed up, it's his mouth. It mentions mouth there because, of course, deceit in the mind doesn't have effect on anybody, does it? It has to somehow be expressed. It's expressed verbally, it's expressed overtly. So the word deceit, and of course the Greek word is different from the Hebrew word, they have different language, but you're still talking about the same concept. The idea of trying to live in an independent from God status and try to get away with it. That's deceit. That's deception. Now, of course, a lot of things grow from that deception. In fact, every area of sin will grow from that deception. But the one who does not have it, the one who avoids that deception, or when he encounters it, he confesses it. And that's what David's going to deal with in the psalm, getting right back into fellowship. Some of this deception enters, deal with it immediately, get back into fellowship. And only then will the believer experience the Asherah promise, the blessing, the happiness. How blessed is the man in whose spirit there is no deceit. You have then represented the happiness of life, or the abundant life that is provided for the believer based on what we can call honesty and relaxation in the soul. Honesty and relaxation in the soul. Now, by honesty means you simply face the facts. Relaxation means you're not intimidated by anything, you're not concerned, you're not upset, but you are totally, well, relaxed is a good word. This promise is brought out in Psalm 34, 12 and 13, as well as many other passages, but since this is just a couple pages from us, we can take a look at it. Psalm 34, 12 and 13. It says there, "Who is the man who desires life? Who is the man who desires life?" Life refers, of course, to the abundant life. It means stability in life. It means happiness in life. "And loves the length of days that he may see good." Good, of course, refers to benefit and stability within your social environment. Verse 13, "Guard your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit." So you have the verbal sins mentioned. Verse 14, "Depart from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it." All of these things relating to both moral and spiritual concepts. And this is how you will fulfill verse 12. So actually what you have then is a further delineation of the Asherah principle, the blessing in time, the blessing in life. All right, in verse 3 through 5, David focuses on the principle of experiential forgiveness. Experiential forgiveness refers to getting or being in fellowship with God in time. Salvation provision is verse 1, and that's once and for all established. But we realize that we get our feet dirty in life. We walk through life and we get our feet dirty. We have to get them clean from time to time, like every day, maybe several times a day. And this, of course, involves forgiveness of sin. David talks about this in verses 3 through 5. He starts, first of all, from the perspective of a believer who fails to use 1 John 1:9, of a believer who fails to get back in fellowship. Instead, when he commits his sin, he basks in it. He enjoys it. And it says in verse 3, "When I kept silent about my sin, my body wasted away through my groaning all day long." Now, "when I kept silent" is pretty explanatory, isn't it? It simply indicates a neglect or a refusal to use God's provision when you've sinned. We've talked about this. Many times we commit a particular sin, and we know 1 John 1:9, but we just can't get ourselves to use it. Many times we think we're taking advantage of God's grace. Other times we look at it from a selfish standpoint. I don't want to let go of this sin. I don't want to get in fellowship. I am enjoying this sin. I want to continue in it. But David reflects for us the true disposition of our soul whenever we hang on to our sin. "When I kept silent about my sin, my body wasted away through my groaning all day long." Now, my body refers, of course, to my whole physical makeup, everything about me, my whole person, in other words. And the word "wasted away" means to wear out. And so you just have the idea of slowly getting to you. Things just get worse and worse and worse. And this is basically talking about the soul agony, the soul turmoil that is there because you are not in a right relationship with God, that then causes an overflow onto the body, so so that you feel the effects of that sin. And that's the word groaning. It says, notice, when I kept silent about my sin, my body wasted away through my groaning all day long. Groaning is inner. Groaning is the attitude on the inside that is there because of sin. It's the human cry in distress. But the human cry in distress, before it is verbal, it is on the inside. And whenever we're out of fellowship, we are going to cry in distress. We're going to feel it in our soul. The emphasis then is on the soul turmoil. The soul turmoil is talked about in many passages, Proverbs 14:30 and chapter 17:22 of Proverbs. So you can hold your place real quick and jump to Proverbs, and we'll look at these two just to review the principle of soul turmoil. It says that Proverbs 14:30, right after the Psalms, of course, it says, a tranquil heart is life to the body. Now, the tranquil heart is a heart that is relaxed and in tune with God in fellowship. No mental attitude sins, no deceit, and this is life to the body. This causes a health effect. But passion is rottenness to the bones, and the word passion represents mental attitude sins in general. We can simply put the idea of deceit there. Although the word is not the same, the word passion emphasizes a disruption in the normal process of soul activity. It's different from the tranquil heart. You can see the comparison. You have a tranquil heart, and then you have passion. Passion is something that is more intense, more violent on the in the soul, a more violent expression of attitude, and it is used to indicate a negative expression of attitude. We call it mental attitude sins. What does it result in? A rottenness to the bones. It causes an effect on the body. You've heard of psychosomatics, psychosomatic illness. This is because your soul is in turmoil and it causes an effect on the body. You're worrying. You have stress. You have hatred. You have various mental attitude sins, some of holding grudges. These type things cause a distortion on the body. Actually, it's been demonstrated that there is a secretion in the body that comes from an overwrought soul, that comes from turmoil in the soul. You have a physical secretion in the body that causes physical damages. And this is usually what results in ulcer. An ulcer usually comes from that. Other effects can be present as well. Many skin diseases are because of soul turmoil and things of this sort. So, when we are out of fellowship and allowing sin to dominate us, see, if we just commit a sin and confess it right away, then we can keep on moving. But if we commit a sin and allow ourselves to stay out of fellowship and allow that sin to blossom, if you please, into more and greater sin, then it's going to cause a great deal of effects, first of all in our soul and then in our body. The second reference is 17:22 of Proverbs. A joyful heart is good medicine, but a broken spirit dries up the bones. Now, a joyful heart, again, is the heart that is relaxed and content and is experiencing the joy of God. But a broken spirit, the broken spirit refers to the spirit that is depressed and therefore, of course, out of fellowship since it's not trusting God. A broken spirit dries up the bones. Again, you have a physical concept here. Dries up the bones does not mean literally that your bones dry up. Yeah, you're walking around, but your bones are dry. No, it's just simply a physical idiom to communicate a physical effect that your body is going to feel the brunt of your depression. And, of course, depression is a type of mental attitude sin. Back to Psalm 32. He mentions in verse 4 the principle of natural and applied consequences. You've heard the term before, I think. Natural consequences are what we just talked about, the effects of sin on the soul and on the body. Applied consequences is when God picks up the stick and he hits you on the knuckles or something. He turns you over his knee and paddles you a few times. And so you have in verse 4, for day and night, 4 is an explanatory of the groaning, for day and night your hand was heavy upon me. Your hand heavy upon me indicates the stick that God applies to his child. Now remember, this is applied in love. All divine discipline is from the love of God. Whom the Lord loves, he disciplines. Always keep that in mind. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 6, Proverbs 3:12, indicating, of course, that God's discipline comes from his love, and it's always for our benefit. David recognizes this, of course. He says, for day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My vitality was drained away as with the fever heat of summer. Now the reason it was is because he failed to respond to the discipline. In Hebrews chapter 12, if we wanted to take the time, we could spend a lot of time in Hebrews 12, where it's about discipline, and it indicates that all discipline for the time is not joyful. You know, when you get spanked, it's not something that is pleasant. But if you are trained by the discipline, that is, if you allow the discipline to get you straightened out, then afterwards it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. But if we fail to respond to the discipline but remain under the control of our sin, and therefore under the influence of this discipline, then what's going to happen is my vitality was drained away as with the fever heat of summer. My physical strength was just slowly, slowly going. Why? Because you're emotionally depressed, emotionally wiped out, and this affects your body. Many of us, I think all of us have experienced this at times. When your soul gets so wiped out, you just don't feel like doing a darn thing. And you just can't get up any energy. Well, this is, of course, because the soul has drained you. And many times it's not the body, it's the soul. Therefore, you have the principle you can apply here. We have many applications, but you can apply the principle of mind over body. That simply means that when you start feeling depressed, recognize that most of the time, physical depression is because of your soul. So just snap out of it. Say, I'm not going to sit here and let this affect me. I'm going to get up and do something. Just move. Now, most of the time, not all the time, sometimes there's a bona fide physical depression that is because the body is just worn out. I mean, if you just worked 17 days straight, and I mean worked 17 days straight, then you're going to feel it. After a hard, you think of these professional athletes, after they've just really gone at it for 2.5 or 3 hours in a football or basketball game, then you think, and then you wonder why they can't get up and, you know, go out and play with the kids, you know. Well, of course, you have the physical depression that is there, bona fide. But most of the time, it's the soul depression that causes a physical depression. Now, notice at the end of verse 4. See that little word, Selah? It's the way it's pronounced, by the way. Selah is a word for meditation. Do you know that the Psalms are songs? All the Psalms are basically songs that were written to be sung and accompanied by musical instruments. And what this word then here is for, it's for two things. It's for a musical pause, so that there's a pause in the music, possibly even a change in the music. But it's not just for that, it's also so that you can pause and look at the information that is just given, and it indicates a change of focus. Whenever you see Selah, it means pause, concentrate on what has just been said, and prepare for a change of focus. It may be a change of music. It may be a change of subject. Maybe a change of emphasis. In this case, it's a change of focus entirely, a change of emphasis, because verse 3 and 4 is failure to confess sin, failure to use the provision of God in fellowship, and verse 5 is I use 1 John 1:9. I get back in fellowship. Verse 5. I acknowledged my sin to you, and my iniquity I did not hide. I said, I will confess my transgressions to Jehovah, and you did forgive the guilt of my sin. Now that's pretty self-explanatory. I don't need to spend any time with that, do I? He used 1 John 1:9. And that's all you have there is the principle of 1 John 1:9. Compare, however, with this statement of forgiveness, or rather confession, the principle of Proverbs 28, verse 13. Proverbs 28:13 gives us the true perspective with regard to confession, what a genuine confession is. Confession of sin does not mean just to say, oh God, I'm sorry. It doesn't mean just to say, God, I confess the sin and leave it at that, but continue to bask in the sin. Proverbs 28:13 says, he who conceals his transgression will not prosper. Now that says just what David just said, isn't it? In the 3 and 4 of Psalm 32. But he who confesses and forsakes them will find compassion. The confession of sin is the statement to God that you have sinned. The forsaking of the sin is the attitude that you don't want anything more to do with it. You have put it behind you. You're not still... You call this guy a name, and now you confess it. Forsaken, it means you're sorry. You're genuinely sorry you called this guy a name. And you don't sit back and say, well, I confess the sin, but I'm sure glad I told that guy off. Not a genuine confession, is it? Because you're still in sin. You're still rejoicing that you told him off. So remember, confess and forsake is very important. Forsake is the attitude. Confession is directed specifically toward God. Confession is directed toward God. Forsaking is directed toward the sin. All right, back to Psalm 32. Oh, notice at the end of verse 5, Selah again. Another musical pause. That was quick, wasn't it? Pardon me. Another musical pause, another change of focus, and another encouragement or concentration and meditation. Therefore, verse 6. Therefore, of course, is based on the last statement in verse 5. You forgave the guilt of my sin. In other words, God is faithful. What does 1 John 1:9 say? If we confess our sins, he is faithful and just to forgive us our sins. So because of God's provision, because of God's faithfulness, therefore, let everyone who is godly pray to you, pardon me, in a time when you may be found. Now, the word godly is not, it's misleading. It looks like this, C-H-A-S-I-Y-D, chassid. Now, do you know what that comes from? You've seen it before. Believe it or not, that comes from chesed. Chesed is all of God's grace provision. We've seen that many times. If you know any Hebrew words, chesed and asherim, right? Well, kasi is one who is the object of chesed. One who has received God's provisions. One who recognizes God's provisions. One who utilizes God's provisions. It does not mean a godly one, as we normally think of it. It means one who is a recipient of God's provisions. And basically, it's one who understands grace. So another way we could describe this person is a grace-oriented one. Because he recognizes that everything he has received from God is from. That is, everything he has received is from God. So, godly one, or rather, he who is godly, is really misleading because it has nothing to do with godliness. It has to do with recognition of grace. And that doesn't mean sinless then, see? It just simply means he recognizes God's grace as David is. David is a godly one. David is a man after God's own heart. You know that. But we just see that David's out of fellowship, or was. In fact, he was out of fellowship for a little while, wasn't he? Because he kept silent about his sin. But God, even after a prolonged period of being out of fellowship, God still forgave David. And so David exhorts others. He says, now, look what God did for me. He'll do the same thing for you. Therefore, let everyone who is godly, that is, let everyone who is grace-oriented, that means in tune with God's plan for your life. See, if you're not in tune with God's plan for your life, you're not going to give a darn about getting back in fellowship, are you? You're not going to care about whether you're right with God. You're not going to care about whether you can experience his blessing or not. You're not going to care about his plan. So the godly one, or the grace-oriented one, is one who is interested in God, and therefore, when he does get out of fellowship, he can turn to God. So David says to those who are out of fellowship, he says, now look, it. See, just like me, if you're out of fellowship, pray to God. Turn to God. He can be found. He's there. He's waiting for you. Every time, every moment is a time when God can be found. If our attitude will get in tune with him, then he will be there waiting for us. And all we have to do is use 1 John 1:9. So, let everyone who is godly pray, and this prayer refers to confession prayer to begin with, and then it refers to prayer in every area of life. In other words, God is faithful. We can turn to him. Therefore, let everyone who is grace-oriented pray to you in a time when you may be found. And once again, that time when you may be found is any time. But keep in mind, by any time we mean, we have to respond to him from our own free will. Psalm 66:18 is the only time when God cannot be found. If I regard iniquity in my heart, the Lord will not hear me. The only time God can be found. Any other time, he's there with his hand stretched out, waiting. And even if we're out of fellowship, he is waiting. Psalm Isaiah chapter 30, verse 18, page 995 in the Old Testament, 995 in the Old Testament, says, therefore, the Lord, and it's Jehovah, longs to be gracious to you, and therefore he waits on high to have compassion on you, for Jehovah is a God of justice. How blessed are those who long for him. See, Jehovah is waiting. He's longing to be gracious to you. He wants to pour these things out to you. Notice it says, therefore he waits on high. That's interesting. It's almost as though you can picture God up there waiting on his throne, looking down at you. You're out of fellowship. You're sprawling, face down in the mud, and he's tapping his foot, just waiting. Well, come on now. Get your head up. All you got to do is turn to me. All you got to do is use 1 John 1. I'm not going to grab you until you turn to me. I'm not going to force myself upon you. You have to want me. And therefore he says, it says at the end of verse 18, how blessed are those who wait for him. Notice the word long there at the end of verse 18 should properly be wait. So at the first in verse 18, the word long should be wait. The margin so indicates. And it means that waiting for him means to trust in him, instead of trusting in our own selves, trusting in our own solutions, which most of the time leads to and is sin. We use our own solutions, and that means, you know, calling somebody a name, hitting him, shooting him, something. God says, hey, leave room for the wrath of God. Don't take your own revenge. Trust in God. We have problems with our daily lives, financial, physical, family, job, whatever they are. Trust in God. Wait upon him. All right, back to Psalm 32. Therefore, let everyone who is grace-oriented pray to you in a time when you may be found. And he's always there with his hands waiting, as it were, to embrace us. Surely, in a flood of great waters, they shall not reach him. That is him, the godly one, the Kasid. Surely, in a flood of great waters. Now, what kind of a problem can be greater than this flood of great waters that just engulfs you? And you might say, well, a fire is worse. But what's the difference? The flood of great waters is simply used to communicate the greatest pressure that you can encounter. Someone might say, well, why didn't he say my house was burning down? Because technically, there's no difference. If you're standing out in a plain, in a valley, and here comes a flood of great waters, hey, you know, what's the matter whether you're burning up or not, you know? It's still the same principle. This is the extreme. So, and the emphasis of that little word, surely, even in the greatest problem, even in the most adverse situation, a flood of great waters, those waters shall not reach him. You don't have anything to worry about, no matter what the pressure is. God will take care of you. And therefore, David says, you are my hiding place. You preserve me from trouble. You surround me with songs of deliverance. Now, there is the key. First of all, in verse 7, then, he says, you are my hiding place. Hiding place is a shelter. It doesn't mean that we are exempt from pressure. It means that we are protected from pressure. The pressure comes, and God has a solution for us. And therefore it says, you preserve me from trouble. The trouble comes, but we are preserved. Remember the principle in Proverbs chapter 1? That the one who listens to me or wisdom will be preserved or protected from the fear of evil. Not protected from evil, but from the fear of evil. In other words, there's no danger. The pressure, the evil is going to come our way, but there's nothing to worry about. There's nothing to fear from it. And then at the end of verse 7, you surround me with songs of deliverance.
The word surround means just to what it says, surround or to encompass. But what are the songs of deliverance? The songs of deliverance are, for example, the Psalms. And the Psalms contain what? Bible doctrine, truth. And this is how David has his stability, because he is surrounded with truth. The songs of deliverance are simply his way of communicating truth that's in his soul. He has put most of the Psalms are written by him, and he has put his doctrinal frame of reference, put his knowledge of truth into musical form. And what he's saying is that I am surrounded by truth. And he says God does it because, of course, the source of these songs is God's truth, not David. So he says, I'm surrounded by truth, and this is what gives me stability. Many of the Psalms talk about how David is surrounded by the songs of truth, the information that he's learned, coming to his mind at night, coming to his mind throughout the day, in time of crisis, in time of prosperity. He's surrounded with these songs of deliverance. The songs of deliverance then represent all the principles of truth that we can learn. For us, it's the entire Bible. The more of it we learn, the more we will be surrounded by truth. And the more we are surrounded by truth, when crisis comes, the crisis can't get through. But if we only have truth around us on the back, crisis comes right through the front. So we have to have this total surrounding. And it's like this. Actually, truth is going to surround us at all times. But here we are in the middle, and we have a little bit of truth. And so this truth has to stretch out. Okay? And the more truth we get, the more truth can tighten up the belt, as it were, or the lines of defense, and the more truth we get means there's less room for the opponent. You get the point. So this guy's going to try, oops, can't go here, I better try and go, oh, can't get in this, oh, hey, there's a hole, I'll run right through that hole. So that's the analogy. I'm surrounded by songs of deliverance, and the more we learn, and pretty soon, it will almost be like a solid line, but you know that even a solid line, a solid bar of steel, has space through it. You know that. You've learned that in science, molecules. So it'll almost appear as though it's a solid line and very, very difficult for some evil, some pressure to get through to us. And that's the abundant life. Not that it is impenetrable. Still, pressure can get in, because we can always break the lines ourselves. We can always say, well, I'm just not going to trust God at this time. But there is the analogy. I'm surrounded by songs of deliverance, and therefore God is my shelter. You surround me with songs of deliverance, all that God has provided for us. And then you have Selah again. Which means, now think about that. Concentrate on it. Musical pause, so everyone listening can sit back and say, well, yeah, I don't know how long the pause is. Might be just, you know, a minute. We don't really have any idea how long the pause is. But it enables the people to kind of sit back and listen. Change of focus. Now, to sit back and concentrate on what we just said, and then prepare for a change of focus with the next stanza. So the next stanza comes, and indeed it is another change of focus. Here you have, then, in the next change of focus, at verse 8, you have David now expressing his soul content to others, because he has reached a point of maturity, spiritual stability. He can now pass on the information to others. Now, I'm going to mention, just for the sake of the argument, the two possible interpretations of verses 8 and 9. Grammatically speaking, it can either be God speaking or David speaking. If it's God speaking, then in verse 8, it is God speaking to David, because the you there is singular, with application to all of us. If it is David speaking, then of course it's David speaking to an individual believer with personal attention in view, and David is seeking to provide information for this individual. Now, grammatically speaking, it can go either way. So what kind of a problem do we have here? I thought we could interpret the Bible clearly at all times. Well, first of all, it's not a problem. It doesn't matter, technically speaking, whether David is speaking or God is speaking, because the information that is given still has the same force. is not a major issue. But a person can't be dogmatic and say, God is speaking here. Or, on the other hand, can't say dogmatically, David is speaking here. However, I lean... I believe that David is speaking. And I'll tell you why I think it's David speaking. Because I have read through the Psalms, and there is not one incident in the rest of the Psalm where all of a sudden God starts talking. Okay? There's not one incident where in the rest of the Psalms, and we have 150 of them, or 160 of them, something like that, there's not one Psalm where all of a sudden God just starts talking. Now, the psalmist will say, God says, and then quote him. But nowhere is just start talking. And this is what we have to do here, right? Just say, all right, so all of a sudden God started talking. However, we have at least three examples where after David recovers, which he has just done, right, he then says, I'm going to teach you guys something. So let's look at that just for a minute, real quickly, so I can finish the psalm up. We want Psalm 34, verse 11, Psalm 51, verse 13, and Psalm 73, 28. All right, now just look very quickly at Psalm 34, 11. Look at verse 4. I sought the Lord, and he answered me, etc., etc., okay? That's Psalm 34, verse 4. I sought the Lord, and he answered me. Then you look down at verse 11. Come, you children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of Jehovah. This is David speaking to others, saying, listen to me. I've got information to give you. All right, turn over to 51:13. 51:13. This is a psalm of confession again. David gets back in fellowship. Verse 10, create in me a clean heart, O God. Renew a steadfast spirit within me. Do not cast me from your presence. Do not take your Holy Spirit from me. Restore to me the joy of your salvation and sustain me with a willing spirit. Then I will teach transgressors your ways, and sinners will be converted to you. Same principle. Psalm 73:28. Look at verse 21. Although this is not David, but this is the same principle. Psalm 21. When my heart was embittered, and I was pierced within, then I was senseless and ignorant. Verse 23. Nevertheless, I am continually with you. You have taken hold of my right hand. With your counsel, you will guide me, and afterward receive me to glory. And then verse 28. But as for me, the nearness of God is my good. I have made the Lord God my refuge, that I may tell of all thy works. So the idea of getting recovering and then being in the place where you can communicate to others. So David is speaking, and he's addressing himself to the people listening. He says, I will instruct you and teach you in the way which you should go. I will counsel you with my eye upon you. Now, the word you is in the singular. So he's talking to one person. But see, that's just the way he's doing it. The singular you is explained by the last phrase in verse 8. With my eye upon you. Personal attention. That's simply an idiom. With my eye, I'm going to give you personal attention. I'm concerned about you. I'm going to give you all the personal attention I can. So the word instruct, the word teach, the word counsel refers to David passing on biblical information or truth information to the people he has contact with. And one thing we learn about David's life is he was constantly teaching truth to many, many people. He was not just the king who was out of touch with everyone. He was constantly communicating truth. And one of the best ways he did communicate truth was by writing songs and getting them out. So I will instruct you and teach you in the way you should go. I will counsel you with my eye upon you. And now he exhorts them, and he turns to the plural now in verse 9. When he says, do not be, he's talking plural now. And he says, now you're all listening to me. Now all of you who are listening to me, I'm exhorting you. Do not be as the horse or as the mule,
which has no understanding. An animal has no free will. An animal has no intelligence, as man has intelligence. In other words, has no capacity to bring in information, correlate that information, and live by that information. An animal operates by instinct. And since it operates by instinct, it's going to panic at the slightest drop of a needle or a piece of straw. And therefore, to control animals, we have to tie them up. We can't tell a horse, now, if you run out and get lost, you're not going to have dinner. So you better stay right here in the yard. We can't tell a horse that. He won't know me. We've got to tie him up. And if we're riding a horse, we've got to have a bridle so we have a little bit of control over that horse or a mule. You've got to control a mule. Boy, mules are on their own. They are the most independent. And you've got to control them. And if you control them right, they can be the most efficient work animals that you can imagine. However, they do need control. And this is interesting. David instructing people, and of course it's God instructing us through David, saying, don't be like a bunch of animals. Don't be like an old horse or a mule that needs to be chained down, held down, whose trappings include bit and bridle to hold them in check. Now, what that means is that if you are an animal, you're going to be controlled by your instinct. And our instinct is what?
Olson nature.
And so he's saying, don't be, and the Olson nature's primary expression is what?
Independence from God.
Don't be independent from, don't be this animal that operates independently from God, that has to be controlled, has to be pulled this way and pushed that way. See, when we're controlled by the old sin nature, we're always off the straight and narrow. We're always going this way, always going that way. God has to hit us with a stick and get back in line. Hit us with a stick on the other, get back in line. Don't be that way. Don't be like a horse or a mule. And then at the end of verse 9, it says, otherwise, they will not come near to you. And we have to change the translation there. The Greeks, the Hebrew says, otherwise, that's correct, there is not an approach, R-O-A-C-H, an approach to you, or a coming near to you. Otherwise, there is not a coming near to you. Now, the words "they will" are added by the editors, are added by the translators. This is the way they wanted to interpret it. But there is no "they" in the context. Here is literally what you have. You have otherwise, otherwise not. One word, B-A-L, bow. And that's a negative with a concession to it. So you have otherwise, otherwise not. All right? Now we have to add in our English, there is. And there's no problem with saying there is, right? Otherwise not. What they did there is otherwise they will not. But see, there's no reason to throw a they in there. Follow me on that. So to just translate it straight, we have to say otherwise not a drawing near. That's one word. It is the word Q-A-R-A-D-H. Carab. Q-A-R-A-D-H. And it is an infinitive. Called a cal infinitive construct. Now, we haven't been technical today, so I've got to be a little technical every once in a while. Keep you all on your toes. Now, the infinitive in the Hebrew is not like our infinitive at all. The infinitive, the construct, is that what you...
Was that
Q-A? Yeah, Q-A. Oh, yeah. Sorry about that. Q-A-R-A-B-H. And the B-H sounds like a B. Harab. In the Hebrew, the cal infinitive functions many times like our participle. So you have a verbal noun type idea, a drawing near. Okay? So there is not a drawing near, and then you have to you. That's correct. There is not a drawing near to you. The you refers to the people he's talking to. David is talking to them. David says, look, if you guys are not going to be in tune with God, if you're going to allow the old sin nature to make you like a bunch of horses and mules, then I have no rapport with you. How can I draw near to you? How can we have fellowship? Now you can see how, grammatically speaking, by the context, we could look at this as God speaking too, couldn't we? Very easily. God says, look, if you're going to be like a horse or a mule, how can you have fellowship with me? How can I draw near to you? How can I approach you? Which is the way the New American has interpreted it, by the way. You can tell by the end of verse 18. See the word my eye? They capitalized my. So that's the way they interpreted it. But there's no capital letters in the Hebrew, so it's not there. No capital. So that's just the way you interpret. If God's speaking, then you want to capitalize my. If David's speaking, then you don't want to capitalize my. All right. And I already explained to you why I feel it's David speaking. All right. If you're going to be, see, David's teaching these people, but if they're going to be like a mule or a horse, that means they're not going to respond to his teaching. And he says, well, how can I have fellowship with you then? How can we have any kind of rapport, any kind of contact? Okay. Verse 10. He then explains to them what's going to happen if they continue to be like a horse or a mule. Many are the sorrows of the wicked. The wicked then refers to the horse or the mule, the one who fails to respond to the teachings that David is giving them. True. And we understand this. We've looked at it many times. This is not unfamiliar to you. If we fail to respond to truth, if we fail to get truth in our soul, then the old sin nature is going to have dominance in our life. And we are going to express wickedness. And what's going to be the result? Many are the sorrows. Many are the sorrows. All kinds of problems. And basically, you can sum it up with Isaiah 57:21. There is no peace, says my God, to the wicked. There is no peace. So you have many sorrows, you have no peace. The wicked refers to, of course, the unbeliever or the believer out of fellowship. This psalm is basically addressed to believers. And it's talking then about the believer who is acting like a wicked one. No, many sorrows, many sorrows. We can all bear testimony to this. When we get out of fellowship and stay out of fellowship, many sorrows, many sorrows. Sometimes even if we commit a particular type of sin, even though we might get right back in fellowship because of the nature of the sin, many sorrows anyway. Sometimes the type of sin is going to have natural consequences that we can't avoid by just getting back in fellowship. Many are the sorrows of the wicked, but he who trusts in Jehovah, chesed shall surround him. He who trusts in Jehovah. Which means to take your free will, direct it towards something that God has revealed to us, which is his person, his character, and his plan. Direct ourselves to that. Trust in him. And let's just... all throughout both the Old and the New Testament, the principle of trusting him. You rich, don't trust in your riches. You mighty, don't trust in your might, but trust in Jehovah. But he who trusts in Jehovah puts total confidence in Jehovah. This is Batak, by the way. That sound familiar? Remember Batak? This is the wrestling term. This is the body slam. You throw a body slam on somebody. Well, this means to body slam everything on the Lord. Take all, just as the, put every, all the force that you use to go into a body slam. That's what you do with all your pressures. You throw them on the Lord with the same force, which means you don't pull anything back. When you throw a body slam, you don't want to hold anything back, do you? So you want to hang on. I mean, you don't want to hang on to any of your pressures. You want to give them all to him, attack. Same principle of Philippians chapter 4. 6 and 7. Stop worrying about everything, but in all things by prayer and supplication, let all your requests be known to God. Same thing with 1 Peter 5:7. Casting all your care upon him, for he cares for you. But he who trusts in Jehovah, loving kindness means grace provision. All the provisions of God will surround him. Now there is what David is saying. If you trust in God, which means you respond to his character and plan, you're going to have provision surrounding you. And there you have again, the believer in the middle with all these things of God surrounding him and protecting him. And once you relate to that concept, once you can trust in the Lord and experience all his provisions, then you have the reality of the abundant life in verse 11. Then you have the reality of the Asherah. The psalm begins with, how blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven. But verse 11 takes it a little bit further and uses three words for happiness. Three words. Be glad in the Jehovah, and rejoice, you righteous ones, and shout for joy, all you who are upright in heart. Before we look at the three words for rejoicing, we're going to look at the two words that describe these believers. The first word is a righteous one, T-S-A-D-I-Y-Q. Tzaddik is a righteous one, and righteousness represents spiritual integrity. Spiritual integrity. The righteous one is the one who is following God's standards in his life with regard to spiritual activity. He's dedicated to the things of God. Falling right in line with that is the word upright one, which is the Y-A-S-H-A-R, and upright emphasizes moral integrity. Which emphasizes, of course, relationship with man. Spiritual integrity is relationship with God, or I should say relating to God, and yashar, our moral integrity, is relating to man. How do we relate to God? Righteousness on his terms. How do we relate to man? On the basis of yashar, uprightness, morality. You cannot be righteous and not moral. You cannot be moral and not righteous. You've got to be both in order to properly experience the blessings of God. In other words, they go hand in hand. And if you claim to have spiritual integrity but are deficient in moral integrity, you're out of fellowship. And if you are the most moral person in the world but have no spiritual integrity, and God has no regard for you. So they go hand in hand. Many times people say, oh, I can worship God. I can be in fellowship and still break laws. They don't understand the principle of morality. But some of the laws are so stupid, it doesn't matter. It's the principle behind it. You obey the law, but you do need to understand the principle of the spirit of the law. There is such a thing as the spirit of the law, which is a teaching that needs to be done. I've taught about it before. The spirit of the law means there are times when you will not obey the letter of the law. Something I will not do. If I am sitting at a red light in the middle of the night, and the cycle happens to be going with, commuter time cycle, and it's the middle of the night, and I'm sitting there, and that light is just not changing, I will go through it. I am not in slavery to a bunch of machines. See? The spirit of the law is, why don't you go through the red light? You don't go through the red light because you respect not only the authority, but the reason it's there. So you don't run into somebody else. But if it's 3 o'clock in the morning, maybe I better make it earlier, 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock people starting to go to work. 2 o'clock, I'm not concerned about the policeman. I'd just tell the policeman if he stopped me. I'd explain to him. I'd say, the spirit of the law. I teach him the principle of the spirit of the law. And I say, I'm not in slavery to a machine. The machine is malfunctioning. I'm observing the spirit of the law. And he still may give me a ticket. But I would not be considered, I would not consider myself as having broken the law. Now, that's something you got to think about and deal with, you know. And where do you draw the line? At any rate. So a lot of people think that they can, you know, break laws. And by breaking laws, I don't mean violating. By breaking the law, I mean breaking the letter of the law and the spirit of the law at the same time. And they think that they can have spiritual integrity and still be deficient of moral integrity. That's not the case. All right, spent too much time on that. Three words for rejoicing. We have be glad in the Lord. Very quick here. S-A-M-A-C-H. Samach. Be glad in the Lord. This refers to inner happiness. This is the attitude. Psalm that means to find pleasure in. Take pleasure in and find pleasure in. It says, be glad in Jehovah. So this is basically an inner attitude. You're tuned in to the character and plan of God, and your soul is just relaxed and happy because you know who He is. You know what He's done, what He's going to do, what He's promised to do. You're tuned in because you know truly. So this is inner happiness. And when there's inner happiness, then it says, and rejoice. The word rejoice is G-I-Y-L, pronounced yield. Yield. Getting that Y in there a little bit. And this means overt expression of happiness. See, literally, the word yield means to go around or go about in excitement. So we have the idea of overt activity. So this is overt happiness. It doesn't mean you have to have a smile on your face, because, well, I've talked about that principle before. I have to protect myself. But it means that the inner happiness is always expressed on the outside, in the sense of somebody comes up to you and all of a sudden you have something to relate to. Now see, when I don't have anything to relate to, my face is just very plain. But as soon as I have something to relate to, then my character's going to come out and express itself. Now, if you have someone to relate to and you still sit there with your smug, you know, no expression face, then that might indicate there's nothing on the inside. And then the third word, R-A-N-A-N, ranan. Ranan. It means to ring out in joyful celebration. To ring out. Notice it's translated shout for joy. So you have the idea of ringing out. And this is the happiness of celebration. So this is joyful celebration. Usually in song. Usually in public assembly, in groups, where you're just singing out. However, it can also apply very, very vividly to singing alone. Singing, you know. I mean, you don't want to be walking down the street singing at the top of your voice. Well, maybe you do. I don't know. But in the middle of lunch hour. But at any rate, it means to not to hold back, not to be concerned about your expression of that joy. It's a celebration word. It's a singing word. And this, then, these three words then fulfill the asherah. The asherah is the total happiness that's in the soul, which is expressed in three ways: inner, overt, and celebration. And the basis for these three forms of joy is the two words in our verse: righteous and upright. If we have spiritual integrity, then we will have the capacity for these three expressions of joy.
The first one is
Samach. S-A-M-A-C-H. And if we are upright in heart, that is, if we have moral integrity, then we will have the capacity for these three expressions of joy. And if we fall, if we are deficient in either area, spiritual or moral integrity, then it simply means we're going to be deficient of the joy of the Lord. The asherah will not be a reality to us. And therefore, the righteous one and the upright one go right back to the last phrase in verse 2, in whose spirit there is no deceit. If you have deceit in your spirit, then you are not righteous and you are not upright. So you have the correlation between the happiness. So, what do we have then to think about with regard to today? Today is Thanksgiving. Today is one of our great holidays. It is a national holiday. It is not a religious holiday. Did you know that? Thanksgiving is not a religious holiday. It is a bona fide holiday. It is the great holiday. One of our greatest. And today is an opportunity then to think about what God has done for us. And this psalm helps us do that. So, what is the thing to think about? That we have available to us everything we need to provide for our souls spiritual and moral integrity, thus to pave the way and give us the capacity for maximum happiness in time. Today,
but not only today, throughout the rest of our life and every day. The issue of inner joy, the issue of overt joy, and the issue of celebration. The celebration of life, if you please, because of who and what Jesus Christ is. You're dismissed.